Is there any objection?
Well, you, I think it's just
a resolution of what Congressman file 13 anyway.
Yeah. It's just a resolution requesting advance 25% more funding.
Yeah.
Okay.
Day is, what day? 12th, isn't it?
Yet.
We also have the.
In no way ties it into performing anything more than we're already performing.
We also have, the committee substitute for the sponsor substitute for 513. I think we should run through that once. I don't.
Yeah.
I expect.
Yeah.
Take any action on that tonight. Now this, I haven't seen this myself, so we can all go through it together. Do you guys have copies of the committee substitute? This is drawn up after our last meeting where we discussed at some length the possibility of making some changes. Section 1. What we're trying to do here is clarify that the merit system is for those employees not covered by collective bargaining agreements. If they're covered by collective bargaining agreement, the merit system doesn't apply. Why don't you gentlemen join us up here? It's a nice informal meeting and jump right in.
Okay, we're going to go through this line by line. The one thing
section by section. Well, what I have in mind.
Anyway, what the hell? I should have said that the tape is probably going.
Gotcha.
Got me. Right on tape. I'm definitely against the merit system going hand in hand with collective bargaining. I don't think it goes. But at this point, I wonder if just automatically dropping it, if maybe we should put, you know, I don't know when the effective date on this is, but putting some type of a phasing out.
July 1, '76.
Yeah. I think maybe we should put some point of a phasing out. You know.
Aren't they in collective bargaining negotiations now with major portion of the unit?
Yeah. I don't think that what we're talking about here is going to affect the people who are covered by collective bargaining. It's aimed more at the idea of applying the agreements one through collective bargaining to those people covered by merit system. And I think the effect is more on people covered by merit system and not by collective bargaining than it is on anybody in the agreements.
Well, there's some people.
We can take a peek at that, though.
That there's people that are, that, you know, this is where the pay raise always hurts. This is not, you figure in what the pay raise is going to cost, and there's a certain percentage of those people that also come underneath the merit system, underneath the collective bargaining, whatever they've set down. Then there's people underneath the merit system. Also, you know, they get maybe a 9% on the collective bargaining, also, you know, someplace in the year get 2.5% raise because of the merit system. And I'm thinking maybe just of stopping, chopping this off, we're talking about chopping it off, but I'm thinking maybe we should get, you know.
I'll look into it, but I think your premise is wrong. I don't believe that it's split like that. I think that, or doubled up or whatever you want to say.
There are some people that are under it. I don't know how many, and that's what I'm questioning.
Alrighty.
There's how many people, and if there are, I think we should, rather than just come down here and half the bill, just zap. But, you know, it's the first of July. Well, it'd be effective in July.
Yeah.
Getting some type of a, you know, phasing out.
We'll
system.
Investigate that likelihood. Section 2 adds a further purpose to the Public Employee Bargaining Act, that of establishing an independent labor relations agency. 3 puts a dollar limit on My gosh. Sign a report, Mike? You passed one out while you were gone.
Just right there. We don't need you to read it, just sign it.
This is one I didn't discuss with the committee, but it's one of my pet peeves, is in an agency shop, the service fee, or agency fee, is the exact same as the membership fee. I tried to find out when I was on Budget and Audit Committee what the costs of representing and bargaining really were, and couldn't find out. It seems to me that they should provide more services than bargaining, so there should be some differentiation in the fee structure. Comment?
If I may, my name's Ken Spray, Fire Trade. I've had a chance to meet everybody. I just got back in the day from Anchorage negotiations. Heard about the meeting and appreciate the call. The only problem that, the thing that I think should be a concern is that I have myself, on many occasions, attempted to cost out what it is on an individual basis. It's an extremely difficult thing to do. I even came up with a pie system where somebody sends what to certain places. And coming from an area where effective bargaining for public employees was introduced and passed in the law the same time that this one up here was, we had the same questions and problems in that particular area. And we did, most of the contracts have agency shop provisions. And the problem that we had with it is that when we did establish that there was a cost factor as close as we could, we found that in some cases it could cost more for the agency fee, and that we didn't have a maintained list of that man at all time or all the background. And he came to us, he normally didn't go to the shop, union shop stewards, but came directly to us and we had to do investigations. But whether you could really tie a figure down to a month, it's rather difficult. And I just wanted to make that comment. We presently don't have that problem in the organization that we have, but we could have that problem. And to cast it out actuarially would be a very, very difficult thing to do.
What you're talking about is costs not involved with bargaining. You're talking about the cost of maintaining the agency shop concept, not the cost of bargaining. And that's what the present language addresses itself to, is to reimburse the exclusive bargaining agent for the expense of representing the members of the bargaining unit. Well,
I just
it's up for grabs. I don't want to make any decisions tonight. I just want to run through it and get comments. And the record is certainly not closed. Greg, do you have a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. What is the service fee? Now, we, in our organization, we have the monthly dues and the initiation fee. And normally the service fee, in our terms, would mean the initiation fee. A person does not have to be or become a member of any labor organization if he so does not wish to, but he must pay the fees that are equivalent to the membership requirement. So the service fee in our terms would mean the initiation fee. What do you mean here when you refer to service fee?
I can't tell you, because that's existing language down to the semicolon. Mm-hmm. That's the way the law presently reads. Mm-hmm. The language past the semicolon is added. As I say, that's one of my pet hang-ups, is that I don't think that the fee that an agent or a person pays to be an agency member rather than a full member should be the same as membership fees.
I see. Well,
Ken says it should be more.
Well, it could be a good point. What you may be forcing the, if this were to become law, and there was a question raised under it, you may be forcing the unions to assess the members for actual cost of their yearly operations rather than set a dues level or service fee level. That would separate the dues money, mm-hmm, and that revenue from being utilized in the actual year-round servicing of the agreements, which some unions probably like to do. They'd like to just pass on the total cost of negotiations right to the members on assessment in addition to the dues. So if we were put in that position, we don't have service fees, mind you, but if we were put in our agency shop, ours is a
closed shop.
Not necessarily. There's only two of those in the nation, one the AMA and the other is the American Bar Association.
Exactly.
But what I'm saying is that most of our members in the Maritime are active members. Mm-hmm. And we even have some of the admins are very active. anyway, I think that if you put that into the law, that may be what you would end up having, is the unions then saying to the membership, okay, it costs X amount of dollars to do this negotiation, now we're going to assess everyone the actual cost, in addition to the membership dues. And that would create some additional revenue for us. I don't think it really meets what you're trying to do here. I don't know. What are you trying to do?
What I'm trying to do is get a differential in the fee for those people who are not union members but pay the agency fee. Presently, the agency fee is the same as the membership fee, and it may be a faulty assumption, but I think that the unions or associations provide more than bargaining services for their members.
Chairman, one thing that this issue up to the semicolon has been before the LRA, and I understand this month they probably will be making their order and decision on that issue. It was alleged by an agency fee employee, and two or three of the organizations were there to testify. When I read the language that now exists in the Act, particularly it says, the last sentence, expense of representing the members of the bargaining unit, that tells me that this fee that's charged, it has to be spread among everybody in the bargaining unit, not just the agency fee, as are the dues. And that was my testimony in that particular area, in that we felt we interpreted to mean that it was a cost for everybody, and each pays for each other. And that does create a problem. I feel that with the added language, who knows where it would be. I would normally think that the cost would be less. That would be everybody's thought, because there are some things that organizations do for their membership exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
Some organizations and associations do some social things when part of that money's there. Some do not, but they do other things to make their membership unite together, I guess you should say. And you could very well get into a situation where if the fee was lower than the actual dues, then you would encourage the members of the organization to go in to become an agency fee person, which we'd end up then really being a service organization and not a labor organization. And I know that they may be the same, but there is a little bit of a difference. That would be my concern. And some of the contracts that we are negotiating now, both with the state and with other public sectors, we are agreeing to, and some of the public sectors close to agreeing to, an agency shop. And that would create us some problems if this language was there.
Okay. Let's Section 4 is picked up from a governor's recommendation in another bill that would add employees of Alaska Disaster Office to that class of employee who is prohibited from striking. Okay, Section 5 is what's left out of the original 513. This was the effort of the Finance Committee to try to get the term and period of contract more in line with the fiscal year. Section 6 is also the rest of that thing. No? Margaret, what happened to that stuff that we're going to slip in from Oregon there?
It's on the
well, that's the state I came from.
You like it?
It's a good state. We went through a strike for Oregon and had some fun with it.
They had some language in there. It's about making the time as near as possible coincide with
the legislative
appropriation period and things like that. I don't find it.
B and Section 8, line 11.
Section 8?
Yeah, that is that language. Are we on that issue, or are we back upon section five?
I thought it was part of section five, that's why I brought it up.
I do have some comments I'd like to make about it, when we get to it.
We'll wait until we get, since we're going section by section. You recall that the first version we had said that the contract, or negotiations couldn't be opened before a contract terminated. That's just to change that language.
If I may, in the, Mr. Chairman, the language which would, in effect, say we're gonna have end up with one-year contracts unless we have a cost of living adjustment somewhere in the term of that agreement. Presently, Tri-Trades doesn't have cost of living adjustment language. We do not have any reference to that at all. And up until we reached an impasse and have it back at the table, but the contract is now open, it is a midterm negotiations only on wages.
And a two-year contract.
Wage classifications, retirement, I believe, and sick leave are the only issues that are being discussed at the table. And the other ones in the agreement are not. I can understand the some of the reason for that. To have a two-year contract with only certain parts of it opening up, that's a standard thing. It is in private sector quite a lot. I personally, myself, try to negotiate one-year agreements. It seems to be much more. 1 year seems to be enough time anymore now, the cost of living and things that happen to us, to be able to make adjustments instead of having to wait 2 years. The midterm on the wages is to provide, at least that's the only part open. Some comments I would have about that.
This would prohibit that.
We'd in fact say that we'd have 1 year contracts from now on because I don't think.
Or multi-year with
or cost. Or multi-year with cost of living. It's going to require, that'll be, that's the only two, that's the only alternative.
Is there a problem in doing either?
Well, we will refrain from and probably continue to stay away from cost of living language in the agreements. There's good things about them and there's bad things. Some cost of living language, which is a prepayment, is probably one of the better approaches to it. But I always felt that if somebody had to wait 12 months and suffer the cost of living and then be paid for, and it wouldn't go retroactively, then it really didn't help them. It didn't keep them up with the cost of living by any means. And so we in Tri-Trades do prevent, and there are no agreements we have in effect now or the ones that we are negotiating that have cost of living language now.
I don't really recall why the B section there was deletes the right of action enforce the agreement. I guess it decided it just didn't need it. It was already there per agreement. Huh? Mm-hmm. On page 2, line 16.
All the agreements I know of have those. Provision now.
The exact same thing. Right. Reverse the word almost.
You're right.
Indeed. They just took it out because it was just a different.
Unless D is. apparently, section 6, so it pertains to the same section of law, and instead of making a sub sentence in paragraph B, it's a separate one in D. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make one brief comment right back to line 13. The language that's proposed here would probably invalidate certain sections of our existing agreement with the state of Alaska. On the ferries. We have provisions in there for reopening negotiations. I testified to this, but I'll give you the exact language. In most labor contracts, they have what they call a savings clause, savings and separability. Ours reads like this. If any rule of disagreement or any addendums thereto should be held invalid by operation of law or by any tribunal or body of competent jurisdiction, or if compliance with or enforcement of any rule should be restrained by such body or tribunal, the party shall enter into immediate collective bargaining negotiation for the purposes of arriving at a replacement of such rule, and Rule 1401 herein shall not be applicable. Rule 1401 is a no-strike clause, which means that you're back at the bargaining table. This would put us back in negotiations if that passed. So, are there other sections where we have provisions or experiments, as I referred to them when I testified previously, where we try on old labor management committee approaches, penalty time in lieu of payments are subject to an annual review in terms of opening and closing the contract. Review or reviews are opening the contract. So that provision, as it now reads, would force us to go back into negotiations and finally bargain for other things that we may have traded off earlier. So I take a position strongly opposing that language. What is the purpose of that language specifically?
That was in the sponsor substitute, wasn't it? The original bill, sponsor substitute, I guess.
I believe that the reason for that was that people on the Finance Committee are finding it terribly hard to project the budget in the future because of things happening with contracts. And I think, I won't speak for the sponsor, but this was my impression of why it was put in there, trying to get some type of a handle on knowing what the next year's budget was going to be rather than having to come in for large supplementals. He originally had in there, too, that all negotiations had to be given to the legislature by so many days. And I think that was underneath the same vein of thought, trying to get a handle on what the payment out was going to be in the future.
Mr. Chairman, I would have to agree with Mr. Cleary's statements. Our contract is a 2-year term with an opener, which we're now in the middle of. And we do also have a savings clause, which in effect would open up the agreement again to make the adjustment. And I guess in effect we'd almost have to do it before June 30 and make this contract terminate and then reopen, which is going to set us off again. So that's one of the issues we do have on the bargaining table is the effective pay raise, if we ever get one, would be January 1. We haven't moved from that position yet. Whether or not we do depends upon the total settlement if we get back to the table. We would have some problems with that. If it was at the time the contract was terminated, it wouldn't be a problem because we could in fact negotiate 1-year agreements. I don't know if it's an encouragement on part of the legislature to have us negotiate every year. Maybe that is a good idea. We do it normally anyway. I don't think that would cause a problem in that particular area once we've got the contract expired. And we're not into a 2-year term or a 3-year term. The only other alternative is to provide for cost of living adjustments then.
The problem with that, Mr. Chairman, if I may, is that if we were to settle for a 3-year agreement, again, depending on what was on the table, we would be very, very sure that built into that would be enough cushion, so to speak, economically, if we were to go back to a cost of living thing, where there would be almost no chance that we would fall behind if we couldn't open the agreement, let's say in case of a national emergency or an economic crash on the stock market or something that put us out of business, that we'd be very fearful of going beyond the 1-year contract. I think the states, or at least the administration, move has been to try to get us to go for longer terms with openers before the legislature meets, so they will have it in their administration budgets, the actual cost. If they were to do this, it would place us in a position of having to negotiate every year, actually every 9 months. We are negotiating the 1977 agreement, which ends June 30 of 77, begins July 1, 77. We are going to negotiate that agreement in August, well in advance of your session, so that you will have the total cost package. If this provision is in there, in the law, before we go to negotiations, I'm afraid we're going to have a one-year agreement thing. A state at this point in time is not geared up to negotiate with labor unions year-round, and that's what they've been doing, because I, as a matter of practice, labor unions, especially where they have different organizations dealing with one employer, in this case the state of Alaska, they're going to find that they're going to stagger these opening dates so that everybody is looking behind over their shoulder to see what Joe got over here, and then he's going to come in and try to top that. This happens anyway, but it will be worse under this kind of a situation where you cannot open the agreement.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I think another thing, and this is evidenced this time in the table of negotiations, there are two bargaining units now negotiating, the supervisors and the tri-trade agreement. And what we found ourselves in is that two groups are meeting same days, virtually the same place, on different floors. One afraid to settle or even try to make a settlement. This was the early stages and we thought we might be able to do that. But fearful that the other one may settle for more or less or something along that line. And of course, administration had to divide its team in half, which I honestly feel, since I served as the spokesman for the tri-trade agreement, caused part of the delay that we're now in, you know, with the fact that we haven't reached agreement. And we are headed to the potentiality of a strike vote and a strike. We're in a foot race also with the legislators. We want to be sure that we, if in fact we get an agreement, it's done before you go home. We went through that last year, and we surely don't want to go through that again. I can understand the concern to be able to have the monetary issues before you in enough time so you can act on them. One of the problems that I experienced, and I guess somewhat unique in the fact that I was working for AP at one time and knew some of their problems in their two contracts on funding, there was supplemental money appropriated, was that the calculations that administration provided were inaccurate. And that's the big problem, I think, is there. I don't know if this bill would cure that. And that's not the only problem in that area. I obtained information from them from their computers just on average hours of work that was over 30 some hours off per month per employee. And it was lower than the actual hours worked. And if that's the, what we have to rely on for information, and legislators also have to do that, that's a problem. I don't know how we could address that. I don't know if this would solve it. I think this would create more delays, longer negotiation sessions, more of those sessions, and staff of the state would have to increase. There's no way they're, in my opinion, at their limits now. And their expertise being limited also causes a real problem. So.
Section 7 has the scope of agreement. Attempts to express what is subject to a negotiation. I guess basically excludes everything except retirement, except for the ferry system.
I do have some comments, Mr. Chairman. It's one of the issues that we're at impasse right now. We are negotiating on.
On retirement?
Let me back up a minute. No, I guess we are not. I'm sorry. We could very well. We had proposed, at least in one particular area of cost, not necessarily retirement, we were proposed and we were prepared to possibly get into that arena if, in fact, the state employees, which I guess is going to take a couple of years now for that to be determined, vote to exempt themselves from Social Security. There's going to be money out there on the table, and we as labor organization definitely want to see that. Not all end up just back in the state's pocket, because we think, my understanding, in order to get out, you must provide something far in excess of the Social Security, which I'm sure our act already does. There would be the matching funds of the employees, if in fact that happened, they pulled out, would probably remain in there, and their pay not be deducted. But the state's portion, even though it's, you know, it's in the area of 5.85, I believe, is a lot of money that could be portions of that, not necessarily its total, used and utilized in improving the retirement system without additional cost. I know the municipality of Anchorage, which is going to go to opt-out, in their proposal, have also proposed that once that opt-out goes through, that the money that the employer made a contribution would have to go to some other kind of a program, either supplemental to retirement, a wage insurance program, or something which would be the benefit. And that's in the ordinance itself that passed, which says this can't happen until the legislators change the PERS where it refers to Social Security, which may or may not happen.
Two things, either include retirement as something to be negotiated for, or else you have to rely on your lobbying ability with the legislature to make sure that it's done statutorily. Greg, is that language look okay for an exemption of that?
Take care of our problem. Okay.
Section 8 is the Oregon language on contract negotiations. It's pretty feeble. All it does is express an intention that doesn't really have anything to measure compliance with.
Mr. Chairman, prior to being fortunate enough to come to the state of Alaska, I was in another fortunate state, the state of Oregon, and represented state employees in a large 17,000 member organization. And we were involved in 3 strike votes under the Public Employee Relations Act, which did not provide for that organization or the herd to conduct the vote. We conducted it ourselves. I just wanted to say that. I intend to say that a lot this session. That is a problem. We were once again in a situation there as we are up here, and that is that we were in a foot race with the date that the legislators wanted to go home. It got to the point to where this very language was contained in an unfair labor practice complaint and later an appeal to the Supreme Court, which lost because it is extremely vague. We were in a situation where we were stalled to the point to where we either had to accept the last and final offer the employer gave or wait a year and try to get a retroactive pay raise on it, which is prohibited by statute in the first place, any more than 6 months. It would have been more than that before they got back. So we ended up having that case before the PERB. They ruled that the language was only an intent. There's no way there could be any enforcement to, and there was no way they could anyway force either side to make a concession at that point. So the House Finance Committee decided that they would go ahead and pass their own pay bill, and they brought both parties in, and they listened to the state side and listened to the union side, and the union side prevailed, and that's the bill they passed. That is something I don't think this state would want to get into. The legislators, in effect, stepping in and doing the job of the administration is charged to do. I don't know if this would cause that. I'd just say that this is a good intent. We have this something very similar to this in our contract, which said that we were willing to meet early, negotiate, and get everything before you as soon as we could. And both parties signed that in good faith. And we surely haven't been stalling, and I have a tendency to think that there has been some foot dragging on the other side, which has caused us to get into a situation where we're now in a foot race. I would hope that maybe if this was adopted, it would make the commitment on both sides, maybe even that much more. It would be, like you say, it is an issue, it's an mention of intent, and maybe that's, sometimes in labor contracts, that's what we end up with. The intent is to do this, yeah. And we both try to do it. But there are always unforeseen problems that happen.
And as I say, there's nothing to measure performance by, and it's virtually unenforceable. I'd like to find something better, but this is what we've got at the moment. Maybe we can be thinking about it. Section 9 is the RUD section. This was picked up from a bill that Lisa was having drafted that would establish an independent state labor relations board.
The only thing I might might add to that, if we could find a way to do it, would be to somehow provide that the three members would have a general background in the field of labor law or union work or personnel work, without having any direct connection with the state or the state employees or anything like that. But you really...
Some standards for appointment.
Yeah, I've been trying to wrestle with it in some way so that you would get people who have a general knowledge of the field, but who don't have any particular interest in any particular side in dealing with issues that would come before this board. It's hard to legislate that.
Yeah, I think that maybe your check on here of seeing that there are people like that would be the check of the legislature. Of course, this would depend upon the makeup of the legislature. I think that this is something we run into a lot of times when sitting at board, that we don't want anybody there with a conflict of interest, but we want somebody with knowledge, and most people aren't going to have knowledge unless they have a conflict of interest, because the way they've gained the knowledge is through working through it, and they're, you know, have attachment someplace with somebody.
I'm sure you could find in the state of Alaska three people who have knowledge but don't have conflict in this situation, you know, who have a general background, say, in labor law, or who have had experience either as a union person or as management dealing with union in the private sector.
Yeah, but that's what I'm still saying. In the state, we wind up with such a small population that there's connections there just through past associates, people they've been employed in the past from, and this type of thing, you know, when it comes down to any of these boards. This has been a real problem because of the smaller population, everybody knowing everybody. So many boards were constantly being saying, well, you know, if you put him on, at least I've heard people say to me, you know, if you approve that person on the board, you know how it's going to go, because even though he's not associated with them now, you know, he's formerly worked with them or had contracts with them or something of this type. And
yeah, it depends on how you define a conflict of interest. I thought when you meant it, you were talking about direct financial conflicts. I don't think you can really, again, legislate against associations.
No. This is where I said I think your check in here is going to come in.
Or for morality.
But this is where the check.
Or even against morality.
Oh, we don't do that.
But that's where the check will come in, is the legislature, and it'll be I think I can see the board being at times either pro one or pro the other, just through who's doing the appointment and what the makeup of the body of the legislature is.
That's very possible.
At that time. And that's the one good thing about, of course, the first whack off is only three people appointed at once, but then eventually they would be spaced out.
The mechanics of this thing still leaves this board dependent upon the division of personnel.
For staff. That's
right.
We should.
Like
what department are we referring to? Department of Administration? There is within the department?
Where you at?
We're talking about Section 9 generally.
Okay,
thank you. It seems to me that we should have some authority in there for them to hire their own staff.
Right. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. Presently, the LRA, and this changes its name, I guess, LRB, which is even, I guess, more better, is in the, you know, they were in a financial situation where they did have some problems, and then the administration did, I understand, transfer some funds to them, $80,000 or something along that line, which still is...
Well, we appropriated some money for them that the administration refused to expend for a purpose.
That, presently, that does prevent a board to serve independent of any control. That is a lot of control. I know I've talked to Personnel Director Pat Hunt about the money for the organization and its functions and what it's done in the past and what it's trying to do now. And we both are in disagreement. He believes that they're functioning as best they could and as best they should. And I totally disagree. I think that there are many things that an LRA or LRB could become involved in, could in fact have maybe an executive director or executive or a director of the organization to in fact do all the work, the research that has to be done. The three members have to rely on a consultant from San Francisco with a long-term record in labor relations, somebody that I've had an opportunity to know for a few years at least, who finds himself in sometimes in conflict because the state of California doesn't have an act anywhere near this good in public sector, and he is a private sector specialist, at least in my opinion. But I find that the problem of not having a staff and not having the independent authority, including funding, has caused us some real problems, such as the fact that we took three strike votes last time. One of the reasons is because they couldn't afford to do it any other way. And we now have requested upon them and expect to receive an answer tomorrow that where there are five or more employees, we feel that there ought to be a state labor relations man there, somebody from the union, somebody from administration with the ballot box so people can vote on the website. Four or less, a registered letter with a deadline. If it isn't returned back, it wouldn't count the vote. I'm sure that, and this is a guess of mine, but I have a funny feeling that they probably will have to reject that because of the funding cost to do that. There are many work sites throughout the state. Most of them are very remote. And it would cause them some problems. I'm sure if they can't do that, that would be their excuse. I would think that in addition to that, there's another thing I think the Labor Relations Board could do and get involved in, which is happening, I think, in the public sector, and that is, in fact, serve as that third disinterested organization to hear complaints on both sides of problems with labor practices. They could also potentially serve, or the chief of their organization, the director, maybe in the area of mediation and disputes in public employment, something I think that ought to be consideration. The man that now serves that function is a federal mediator, very capable man, both respected by management and unions, but he's got a peak year coming up right now in the construction industry, and he's got tremendous which he must follow up, and he's by himself in the state. They do have mediators in Seattle they can use and borrow, but their expertise is private sector, and it is a federally funded organization. And that was just some things that I was thinking about, that if we got to the point of giving them the funds to operate, they ought to be able to operate like a real labor relations agency should, including involved in some labor disputes and try to bring in wins. I know that the other large labor employee relations board, I guess in the state, would have to be the municipality of Anchorage, and they're rewriting their act. But I know their chairman got involved in mediating just recently, and probably is going to result in an agreement. I think it can be used that way, and something to take a look at.
I took a look at the law this afternoon. I didn't have time to read it word for word, but I believe that the law is written in such a way now that it does not preclude that from happening. If we set up this board, section 70 through 260 that it would act underneath would allow it to get into mediation, hire a mediator if need be, or I don't think it precludes it from doing some of their own mediation if there are people who can handle it and who can do it. Were you referring to unfair labor practices when you talked about
one thing?
Yeah. That's also covered under the
Yes, I was, and that's a dispute they do get involved in, but I think there are other things that are not unfair labor practices that they could, such as they could be mediating right now in the dispute that we now have with the state, if they are in fact independent of supervision of either side.
Yeah.
And I think they could have an impact on resolving that because they are more knowledgeable of what's happening in the public employment, at least they should be, especially in this state.
I wouldn't want to tie it down to requiring them to do it, though.
I can understand
because
that.
Depending on who gets appointed, you may have the expertise there and you may not.
That's true.
I mean, Anchorage is lucky they've got Jerry Thorne there right now.
Yeah. I was thinking of another thing, and you were speaking about that. How do you get people on board that have expertise? Maybe it's not like we want to go to arbitration here, but maybe there's one way to explore, and I haven't given it a lot of thought because the more I think about it, I can see some problems with it, but maybe the administration or the governor could appoint one. The labor organization somehow get together and agree to appoint one, and those two pick a third, and that their terms run 5 years or something like that. So they could in fact, in effect, you would have one representing each side and somebody in the middle to be the chairman to swing the vote.
You're talking now for membership board.
Yes, I'm getting to that right now. The language now is here. I would support in that it's a step in the right direction, the present system, in my opinion, and the way it was done. Could have some problems. The members of the board are very, very good people. I would not speak derogatory of any of them. They do have some limited ability in the area of labor relations. There is a little difference between personnel involvement in personnel administration and labor relations. I've always said that personnel administrators or directors, they've had the control of the state over 10 years now of personnel relations, and they can't give it up, and they're not really giving it up. I mean, they now have to share that responsibility, and that is very hard for a personnel director to do, but somebody with expertise in labor relations may not have that problem.
Yeah, when you mentioned, I had been thinking about that too, and my point was that the legislature would probably be a check on that. So of course it would depend upon, and I can see where getting a bunch of unions together might be very, very hard for them to come up with one name that they're all going to support. I was wondering how it would be saying that they would supply a list of perhaps five names from which at least one, you know, but then they would give the governor the option to pick one of those names. I know this is done in other areas of the board. Sometimes, the people that are concerned supply a list, and then the governor has the option of picking from that list.
That would be.
Would you go the next step then and have a list for the governor to select from, the governor to select his own name,
the governor
from the unions, and then those two select the third? Or what?
Well, how are you going to select that third when there's really the two parties involved, and the employees and the governor? How that third person, I really don't know, but saying that, that at least one of the members shall come from a list of just, five people submitted to him by the unions or bargaining units affected by this law, something of that nature. And that way would give leeway for, a variety of names to go in and maybe not the...
Lisa?
I have real reservations about the idea of taking representatives from labor and representatives from the administration in any way. I don't think the board should be constituted in that way. And the reason I don't is because that... What you're really doing is taking out one person on this side and one person on that side, and you're making an impossible situation for the person.
Yeah,
it
shouldn't be.
It's really, what's the point of having a board if one of them's already committed here and the other's already committed there? The point of the board is to look at the whole picture without prior commitments and come up with we hope and pray an even-handed and just solution to the problem. That's the first point. The second point is that a lot of the problems that arise, unfair labor practice complaints and so on, they're not black and white. They're not where the union person can automatically say, yeah, the union's always right, or vice versa, the administration person. They themselves would find themselves in a very difficult position, because it may be the administration person is going to have to find that he's going to have to go against all the administration people that put him there and say, look, you guys really goofed. And that's a difficult situation. I really shy away from the idea of putting representatives of any organization or any of the parties onto a board like this. I think they should be disinterested. I think they should have a general background, so they have some knowledge of what they're doing. But I really think that they should be disinterested third parties that don't have any connection and nothing at stake.
I don't think.
I was just going to talk about the personnel. You mentioned that there's no relationship between the personnel and the
labor. No, there is, but it's not that direct.
What is it? Yeah, the point I wanted to make was that when I said that someone ought to possibly have some background in personnel on the board, I was thinking of things like determining the bargaining unit, for instance. You have to get into things like classifications and work stations and
all kinds of job descriptions and all kinds of things that, you know, if you have a background in personnel, it's kind of useful to know a little bit about that stuff when you're determining the bargaining unit. So that's why I mentioned it, but I recognize.
I wasn't, you know, I was just making a comment as well. But that's been my belief.
Do I gather then that we're inclined to leave it as it is or not?
I think, what was the suggestion that I thought was a good one?
Any members appointed by the government?
Oh, the staffing, yes, you should have the right to.
No, I'm talking about the composition of the board at the moment.
How about that? I'd like to know how they feel about the five-year term. That's a thing, it'd be kind of long, kind of, maybe it would help in a way, but maybe that's a long time for a tight term, something like the regents.
Ramona?
I feel that the safety in the five-year term, basically I'd be against a five-year term, but if you have all three people, which will hit, of course, if this bill is passed and goes into effect the first time being appointed by a governor, I see that the point of the five-year term is that at no time is one governor, the general rule, going to appoint all people to this board. And I don't think you're ever going to get anybody to serve on this board that doesn't have an interest in this field or hasn't been into this field before. When you mentioned getting disinterested parties, I don't think you're going to get that type of people to serve on this board. I feel that there is some validity in giving, you know, some place a selection to these people, because this is my fear once again, and it's sort of taken away with the five-year term, that if you get a governor that's very pro-labor and a legislature body that is very, very pro-labor, they're going to put very, very pro-labor people on there. If you get a governor that is anti-labor and you get a legislative body that is very anti-labor, they're going to be placed on there. And your only check and balance right now is the confirmation.
That's what I was thinking about.
And it's not unusual to have an organization or organizations like the doctors putting forth names from which to select them. In some areas it is done.
Not usually done in an area where you've got two groups that are usually confronting one another.
No, not where they're confronting one another, but...
The reason I like the five-year term and the reason I suggested is because with a three-year maximum on the bargaining agreement, I have a feeling that you can get board members who are going to outlive an agreement that may be entered into during their term. There's going to be some continuity there over the length of the term of an agreement. Not, of course, it won't always work because people's terms will be running out all the time, but I feel that the board ought to have a longer continuous function than the agreements, the bargaining agreements. As a practical matter, I'm sorry to say that probably people will resign before the 5 years are over. But I think it's worth shooting for.
Mr. Chairman.
The other thing I was going to say that on here, I don't know if anybody would want to put it in. I know it's put in some boards that they can't serve consecutive terms. Now, I have no feelings about it one way or the other. I just throw it out because I know some pieces of legislation I have worked upon that they have it written in there that they can't serve, you know, consecutive terms, that they can't serve, you know, like the first guy that's appointed for 1 year, he might be able to fulfill, you know.
For the five-year term, they might not be a whole lot of demand.
That's right.
No, but I've done their time. But if you have somebody...
You think it should be prohibited?
I'm not saying I think it should be prohibited. I'm just saying I was just looking at something that I've noticed that is in other people's pieces of legislation. I don't have no feelings about it one way or the other.
Skip it then. You wanted to comment on it?
Just one comment that may get you off dead center on the question of the makeup of the board and the background of the people. The Employment Security Advisory Council, of which I'm a member, is comprised of so many persons from labor, so many persons from public, so many persons designated as management. I don't know whether you want to get into that area, but they are designated, they must come from those communities of interest. And you may wish to specify that, this may be a requirement here, that one member should have a background. And I've seen this in the, well, it's, there are several laws that have this on the books. The pilotage law that, that Marine, the Board of Marine Pilots requires that one of them be a licensed Marine pilot, one be from the maritime industry as an employer, and another be from the public or have another community of interest. So it is not unusual to specify. You obviously wouldn't want to have three doctors on this board or three dentists.
No.
Or four guides, or so.
You wouldn't want to have
three labor persons.
Three union officials.
That's right, obviously.
Well, I guess we generally agreed that we want to try to apply some standards for these people.
Yeah.
And I gather we're generally agreed that we want them to be able to employ their own staff, too.
Now, are you, sorry, I don't know your name.
Ken Spray.
Sorry.
I know who you are. You should know who I am. We never met.
I know your name. I know you now. You mentioned, now it's gone out of my head. Oh, you mentioned that this would still be within the Division of Personnel. I don't read it that way. I read it, there is within the department. I'm taking
department,
it back.
Department
of Administration, right? Yeah. So it's not within the, would not be within the Division of Personnel.
No, but the Department of Administration has division personnel in it, and normally they rely extremely heavily on the director of personnel for labor relations expertise.
I know, that's the whole point, yeah.
Right. That's for accounting purposes only, because there's some language in there.
I don't agree with that approach at all, because, I don't. I think the personnel director wants to control and hold on to something, and labor relations specialist, I honestly feel that it's governor's wish, I guess, but I honestly feel that he should have a labor relations specialist equal to the personnel director, but dealing exclusively in labor relations. And where the overlap comes, which is in some areas it does, that's the commissioner administration's prerogative to put whoever he should there.
Does this bother you the way it's written?
No, it doesn't bother me. No, I said, I made a comment, I thought it was a step in the right direction.
Okay. I thought you were saying that it was still going to be within the personnel somehow, but I did want to avoid that.
Okay, Section 11 is a beauty now. This redefines public employee to exclude managerial, professional, and confidential employees. At the same time, it drops that non-certificated employee so that they're now subject to representation.
This definition, and
then goes ahead and attempts to define confidential, managerial, and professional, which are exempted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to ask, this definition here is only as far as the Labor Relations Act applies itself. Find that out. In effect, then we say that the public employee is everybody but these. And that's basically what I've seen in many public employee acts, labor relations acts, is definitely along that line.
My qualms are about the professional employee. I don't think we have too much problem with the confidential and managerial employees, except for the matter of definition, make sure that we try to explain what we're talking about. But I think professional employee is a matter of some discussion.
Professional employee?
Yeah.
Especially the last phrase, when the person is employed as a teacher, the person is
that's a double exception.
That's really in the fire, yeah.
No,
I know.
That's a double exception. They're already being
represented.
Mr. Chairman, the Marine unions have at the moment under dispute, and we are involved in preparing processes. In fact, we're in litigation now on the issue of whether or not the ferry employees who are covered on an earlier permissive piece of legislation that provided that the Commissioner of Public Works may negotiate contracts or enter into agreements with labor unions for operation of ferries. We did not support the Public Employees Relations Act when it was passed in its form. We didn't oppose it because we specifically requested we be exempted from it because we already had a relationship with the state that was satisfactory to both parties. I don't know whether it's a proper time here, but the position that we have held over the years is that we are separate and apart, and we do not do business with the state like other public employees. We deal directly with the Commission of Public Works. And I can read you the section I'm referring to if I could borrow the statute from Representative Byrne.
Yeah.
It's under 23-40.
I'm going to grab some more coffee. Does anybody have some coffee?
I'll take a cup as long as you're gone.
Anybody else have a staffing tonight?
Where is the labor relations agency defined now? We want to make it independent. Where is it defined now?
I'm not sure where you can find it, but it is the State Personnel Board is also the State Labor Relations.
I think the only place you find it's in the definitions, like 2340.
Yeah.
250.
Yeah. Number three. In the session of 1962, the following was passed. It starts here on 40-040. Oh, I see. Collective bargaining agreement. The Commissioner of Public Works, or the authorized representative in accordance with 10 through 30 of this chapter, may negotiate and enter into collective bargaining agreements covering wages, hours, and working conditions, and other employment benefits with the employees of the Division of Marine Transportation engaged in operating in the state ferry system as masters or members of the crews and vessels or their bargaining unit or agent. No collective bargaining agreement is final without the concurrence.
Lisa, thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you.
This section here. This section was passed in 1962 to provide for when the Malaspina and Matanuska-Taku size ferries came online in 63. We have dealt within the confines of that section ever since then.
What's the citation on that again?
2340-040. Now, when PERA was passed in 1972, we testified and appeared before all the committees involved. In fact, in 71, when it was bottled up in Senator Clyde Lewis's Labor Management Committee in the Senate, we also testified in opposition to including the Marine unions because we already had a established procedure and a law that covered it. That is why you will find that most of the Act does not, or we, that's why we come before you and ask you to exempt us from things, because we have private pension plans and other things.
So what your bottom line is going to be then, the public employee definition should exempt those people covered by 2340-04.
That's right. There are conflicting attorney general's opinions on this issue. The original opinion that the state relied on was rendered by Attorney General Norman Gorsuch during the Egan administration, where he stated that by implication that section was repealed, but it was not carried in the repealer. It was originally in the bill that was being